Please be seated. We have one case for argument this morning. We're going to have your arguments in the SunTrust versus United Guaranty case. We'll hear from the appellants.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Theodore Olson on behalf of Appellant United Guaranty. The central issue in this case is whether the underwriting guidelines currently being used and mutually agreed upon for the loans made by SunTrust were the guidelines prescribed by United Guaranty containing the standard form desktop underwriter requirement. In order to obliterate all evidence.
Break that down a little bit for us because you really lumped the whole thing together.
So I tried to, Your Honor.
I can see well why you would.
I think the key document is the key documents are the ones that say the insurance will cover loans issued or made pursuant to the guidelines prescribed by United Guaranty. That is in the master policy itself, that expression. And it specifically provides that the guidelines shall be the ones prescribed and amended by United Guaranty.
Is that the part two where in the master policy where it does it not say that the certificate itself indicates coverage, or is that something
the,
you
the certificate was an accounting entry that would show that a particular loan had a certain number. Coverage would be determined when a claim was being made. And the operative condition, which was central to this case, was specifically set forth in the documents that are in the record, prescribing that the guidelines would be those currently being used and mutually agreed upon. And the question in the case was whether the guidelines being currently used and mutually agreed upon were the ones that SunTrust prescribed for its own loans or the United Guaranty guidelines that were evolving as the case went on, as the loans changed. And as I said, the key issue in the case is determine which guidelines were applicable. And in order to obliterate the evidence that it was United Guaranty's guidelines that contained the governing standards, SunTrust and its most senior officials, including its CEO, its general counsel, senior lawyers, and senior vice presidents, engaged in a willful, prolonged, comprehensive, and, as the district court put it, unconscionable scheme to perpetuate a fraud on United Guaranty and on the United States District Court. That effort involved altering and concealing the documents that would have proved that it was the United Guaranty guidelines and not the SunTrust guidelines. They even said in a document that's found at Joint Appendix 696 that they did these alterations in the documents were made so that if the documents that were altered were recognized as true without alterations, then we can't sue.
Tell me where that goes. I understand, and that is clearly what happened in terms of the initial action dealing with the alteration of the emails. But tell me where it goes in terms of our determination here. If we can agree that Virginia law controls, we do.
Well, up to a point. I mean,
the law that I'm referring to specifically has to do with the interpretation of contracts under Virginia law from an insurance perspective, that the ambiguities are resolved in favor of the insurer. That is agreed. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. Because
I'm misstating Virginia law.
What I'm saying is in the Axona case, which is a decision of this circuit, this court specifically said in footnote 5 of that case, a presumption in favor of the insurer doesn't govern in connection with a summary judgment motion, that the decision that because a summary judgment procedure is procedural as opposed to substantive. I will also say, Your Honor, that the...
Oh, don't take me too fast on that because I want to understand how something this court says will trump what the Virginia law has said if the Supreme Court of Virginia has given a statement in terms of what the law is. And that's what I'm getting at is, are we bound by the law as it is in Virginia in the interpretation of insurance contracts.
I might say, first of all, that the law in Virginia is not quite as clear as all of that, because this is not a contract of adhesion. This is a party, two sophisticated parties dealing with one another, a major lender and a major insurance company. And it isn't always the case. Ultimately,
I don't think it's a question of adhesion of contract. It's insurance contracts. I don't think insurance contracts in Virginia, as in many states, it's not a question of adhesion. It's the interpretation of insurance policies if there is an ambiguity in that policy. That's what I'm getting at. And I'm not talking about unequal bargaining.
Well, the presumption in favor of an insurer in case of ambiguity is something that arose out of the unbalanced relationship typically between insurers and those who are insured. The Virginia Supreme Court, I just wanted to address the point that you were making, has made it clear that ultimately the contract, what is the intent of the parties, ultimately governs with respect to this. But I would also say the case that I was citing is the Axona case, which is at 622 F. Second, beginning at page 90. And the court specifically addressed this very point that Your Honor was asking me about with respect to the presumption in favor of insurance companies. Axona, this is in footnote 5 on page 93. Axona contends that if the warranty provision is ambiguous, it must be interpreted in favor of coverage. This was a summary judgment procedure. The court went on in that footnote and in the text of that case to say, the summary judgment procedure, as opposed to the substance of the law of the state, governs with respect to summary judgment, so that if there is an ambiguity, it is a question of fact which must be resolved by trial rather than summary judgment.
Does it make a difference then in Axona, the author of the document in question there was not determined, but here the insurance company authored?
I don't think it makes a difference with respect to what the court was deciding with respect to whether federal law governed under Rule 56 as a procedural matter. That's what the court specifically said in that footnote, as opposed to the substance of law of Virginia. We would say furthermore, however, the fundamental issue in this case is whether or not this is a partially integrated contract. That's the key to the case. There isn't any question that the insurance policy and the insurance coverage documents incorporated by reference underwriting guidelines. The original policy specified that those would be underwriting guidelines prescribed by United Guaranty. That makes sense. The insurer wanted to make sure that it was insuring something that was issued, a loan that was made pursuant to its own standards. Made that clear right from the beginning of the policy, and it says, because this particular lender was issuing many, many, many different kinds of loans under various different kind of circumstances, that this delegated underwriting process would take place, which is very common in this industry, and so that you allow the lender itself to determine to apply particular underwriting guidelines, but you don't want to insure something that is wildly out of balance with respect to those guidelines. Hence the underwriting guidelines. And the desktop underwriter is a provision that's a standard form developed by Fannie Mae, which is used throughout the industry to allow an assessment of risk. And so the prescription was...
Tell me about the desktop underwriting. Is that phrase, the approval is needed? Does that arise from the flow plan, or does that only show up in this guideline matrix?
It shows up in the guide. The reference to the desktop underwriter shows up in the matrix itself, and that is a part of the guidelines. It's a long piece of sheets of paper with have various different standards on it, and it specifically refers to the desktop underwriter. I think the central point is that in order to determine these very points that we're talking about, you have to look at those various documents and the emails that were back and forth that were an ongoing process with respect to these loans inform that. Now, it's very strong evidence that SunTrust believed that those email documents demonstrated that it was United Guaranty's guidelines that were supposed to be applicable. Otherwise, they wouldn't have tried to change them to reflect a different set of facts and a different set of conclusions. They thought they were fundamental. The judge below said that those email changes were fundamental to the substance of their case against United Guaranty, and therefore they felt they had to change them. It proves the point. It's very, very strong evidence, if nothing else, that United Guaranty was correct. And they even said in the document to which I referred to a moment ago, if she admits that these, in fact, were the changes, then we can't bring our case. Their case were pivoted upon the emails being changed. That's why it was so harmful.
So how is the belief on behalf of SunTrust different from what one could maybe derive from the evidence that United Guaranty continued to bill for premiums and pay claims after you found out there were certain claims that were not DU approved?
That's a question of fact, and it's specifically the facts in
I'm only addressing the belief. You want to say that the actions of the parties are something we can take into account in determining what the contract says, and if you are continuing to ask for premiums and to pay claims, even though you know it's not approved for, what, 1 or 2 years, what it would seem to me that's a little bit more than just saying goes to something else.
Well, Your Honor, in the first place, they weren't paying claims that they knew were not approved by the desktop underwriter. It took a while for them to get that knowledge. We're talking about 1,300 claims out of 90 to 100,000 different policies that were covered by this. The premiums, this was an installment contract. The judge below found that.
Are you saying they paid them unknowingly?
That they paid claims when they were presented to them, sometimes inadvertently, but when they did find out, the record is clear about this, when they did find out that loans were made without compliance with the desktop underwriter, they did challenge those. They said they weren't made. We're not going to pay those claims. SunTrust initially agreed that that was correct. It later changed its theory. But, Your Honor, the point is, with respect to the premiums, As the court below pointed out on page 1,110 of the record, 1,114 of the joint appendix, this was an installment contract. SunTrust had the right to pay for the premium in a lump sum in advance or in installments.
Well, let's not get hung up on that. Let's tell me a little bit about the good faith aspect of it in terms of the premiums, because you just got
Yes, the good faith aspect of it. There are several reasons why that implied covenant of good faith and the breach of good faith is not a defense at all. In the first place, it came up sua sponte by the trial judge 4 months after the trial. United Guaranty objected to it, said, let us reopen the evidence, put that evidence on.
Now, make sure I understand you. You're saying it's not a defense, it's not an affirmative defense that has to be asserted?
It is an affirmative defense that has to be asserted, and it's something that wasn't justified by the evidence. It was brought up. Neither of the parties put on any evidence of that during the trial, and the judge specifically said, in his opinion, said neither one of the parties have mentioned this. They haven't discussed it.
Comes up after the trial.
Comes up 4 months after the trial, after the post-trial.
So you say you weren't prejudiced.
We weren't.
So you weren't prejudiced by this right here. Were you prejudiced?
Well, of course we were prejudiced, and there's the cases of this circuit said that you can't come up with an affirmative defense after the trial is over with post hoc sua sponte with respect to this, when the other side hasn't been able to put on any evidence with respect to it.
It's like $92 million would prejudice about anybody, wouldn't it?
That would be prejudice, very definitely. And another point that was a part of this thing, and the judge pointed this out too in his opinion, SunTrust wanted to continue making the premium payments because it affected the coverage for these $90,000 to $100,000 policies. They if the premiums had been rejected and the policy had been determined, it would have harmed SunTrust to the tune of some $45 million because it was a maximum level of coverage that continued to apply with respect to all these other policies. So SunTrust itself wanted to continue the premiums being made so it would continue to have coverage. And, of course, it did. At the end of the day, $280 million of coverage was paid out of a 287 possible maximum limit with respect to this. The premiums were installments, and that defense is no defense at all. Ultimately, with respect to the judge's decision, with respect to the $92 million worth of premiums, Your Honor, SunTrust wound up better than they could possibly have come out, even if the contract had been performed as they said it would. There's no law in this country that suggests with respect to breach of contract that kind of a result would be acceptable. At the end of the day, the sanction should have been dismissal of the complaint by SunTrust and their damage claims. The evidence would have supported, had there been a trial, had that evidence of the fraud been permitted, it would have supported United Guarantee's position. Now, I don't want to abuse my privilege.
No, but answer one question. There was an attorney's fees question. Apparently, that was resolved by the trial court that's not the issue in bench trial. And in the process of doing that, I seem to recall part of it was maybe you didn't want this whole business of good faith to come up. Would that be a basis for notice on the part of United Guarantee?
No, as a matter of fact, with respect to that, and this is, I'm reading from Joint Appendix 1447, another reason this was so that the attorney's fees would be settled. This is a letter from McGuire Woods, the attorneys for SunTrust, saying another reason why you should settle with us with respect to the attorney's fees is so that the possibility of bad faith won't come up in the case. You will escape that possibility. It was also, and it's in the briefs, a statement in court to the district judge saying this would preclude any exposure to a bad faith liability.
Thank you. So we have a little time left. We'll hear from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor. So may it please the court, Ray Cardozo for SunTrust Mortgage. The court is, of course, correct that you apply the controlling Virginia law as handed down by the Supreme Court.
What was the case Mr. Olson just cited on it? Axionic case?
Ascona.
He says if the part is, I think this is what he was going at, you know, this is not a contract of adhesion. You guys are equal. You don't get the kind of consideration that mom and pop out there get a policy on the house and a big insurance company. That the law is different on that.
Absolutely not. There are multiple things wrong with Ascona. Let me take them in order. First of all, the rule that ambiguities are construed against the drafters, the rule is ambiguities are construed in favor of coverage because the nature of an insurance transaction requires absolute certainty before the loss occurs. So the insurer has an obligation to make it clear in the operative policy documents itself what the deal is, not in some side discussion. And if there is a lingering ambiguity as a result, the insurer has to bear the loss because that, of course, enforces the first duty of making it clear in the operative policy documents. There's nothing to do with sophistication at all, and there's no support for that proposition under Virginia law that there's any exception for sophistication. The Ascona rule
we first resolve the question of whether there is an ambiguity?
Correct. There's two.
And if it's a latent ambiguity, we can accept extrinsic evidence on that question.
If there's Virginia law does three things that take Ascona completely out of play here. Number one, the parole evidence rule has been quoted by the district court. No place adheres to it more strictly. There's what will be characterized as an ambiguity is limited. The types of ambiguities that will permit extrinsic evidence, not a patent ambiguity, only latent ambiguity. And then at the end of the day, even if you have an ambiguity, the trier of fact cannot credit extrinsic evidence to return a finding against the insured if the insured's construction is at least reasonable. All three of which were part of the district court's holding order in this case, all three of which United Guarantee has to set aside. And if I could just start with the first point on ambiguity. The point that Mr. Olson glossed over is that the master policy language that he quoted from, the flow plans that use the word SunTrust Mortgage Guidelines, is an amendment to that language. And think about what that means. We start with a provision, and it's on JA 115, which is section 1.37 of the master policy, where the insurer uses a clause that twice says designated as that the guidelines are going to be those designated as such by the company, and then later in that phrase, as amended and restated by the company. Clearly and explicitly, initially, the phrase by the company appears not once, not twice, to tell its insured we're the ones who are issuing the guidelines.
So it's got to be guidelines by SunTrust from your perspective.
When you amend that to replace it with the phrase, these loans will conform to SunTrust mortgage guidelines, and you drop the phrase, they want to say that this means guidelines prepared for SunTrust mortgage by the company. Now, if that's the language you're amending, you'll carry over the phrase by the company. And if you don't, you bear that loss, not your insured. Because remember, another undisputed fact in this record, SunTrust went ahead and underwrote this loans using SunTrust mortgage guidelines.
Now, do we, in the interpretation of this contract, do we only look at what the language is here, or does the conduct of the parties help us to understand what this language means? Is that permissible under Virginia law?
Well, remember, three steps. It has to be a genuine ambiguity, and there really isn't when you change the language of that. Because Virginia law says we strive as much as possible to do it from the writing. But then remember the type of ambiguities that Virginia law will tolerate extrinsic evidence on. Here's a direct quote from the Virginia Supreme Court's decision in the Gallagher case that was cited to the panel. Only when the ambiguity is not self-evident from the writing, that is, where there is a latent ambiguity in the use of is the use of parole and other extrinsic evidence permissible? You're telling me this argument, this ambiguity, isn't evident from the writing?
Yeah.
It's not evident from the writing.
Tell me that it's not. Tell me why it's not.
Because an easy way to look at why it's evident from the writing is because the insurer's position that SunTrust mortgage guidelines means SunTrust mortgage guidelines, not something prepared by United Guarantee, that comes right out of the writing. It's the ambiguity, their contrary construction is one that comes right out of the writing. Here's an example of one that's not evident from the writing.
That ought to be a good lesson not to ask the question to a court. You might get it asked back.
Yeah, I know better than that, Your Honor. I'll try not to make that misstep again. One of the cases cited to the panel involves an example of a latent ambiguity. It's a case called Southern Insurance Company versus Williams. In that case, the contract's clear, and it refers to the insured, a particular entity. Turns out that entity doesn't exist. So you've got an ambiguity that isn't apparent from the writing, but when you go to apply the language, you can't do it. There, then you get into the course of dealing and realize they use a term meaning one line of business, not another. That's apparent when you go to the extrinsic evidence. But then now we come to Ascona. Even if, and the district court held, even if, remember, the district court has heard all of the sanctions, all of the extrinsic evidence that's out there. He says, even if I consider all of this evidence, give every reasonable inference to United Guarantee, soaking wet, this extrinsic evidence will never dispel the ambiguity, and therefore the operative rule is the one this court stated in its decision in the Joseph C. Borstein case. As we have recognized, the courts of Virginia consistently apply two rules in construing the language of insurance policies. First, while language in an insurance policy is susceptible of two constructions, it is to be construed liberally in favor of the insured and strictly against the insurer. Second, where two interpretations equally fair may be made, the one which permits a greater indemnity will prevail. This rule was applied in Borstein in 1987 to hold that an insured had a right as a matter of law on summary judgment to a duty to defend determination. That's 7 years after Ascona. That immediately tells you.
If this is a partial integration case, as Mr. Olson alleges, then how do we look at those matrix guidelines if we accept that it's a partial integration case?
The partial integration doctrine also incorporates these same limits. You can remember the parole evidence rule is also a limit on not just a limit on whether you can consider its extrinsic evidence, but also how it can be used. So in a partial integration case, you can proffer evidence that's consistent with the text, SunTrust Mortgage Guidelines. You cannot proffer something that changes the meaning of the phrase that it appears, because the insured is entitled to rely on the text. And if you're getting something that strays too far, you're outside the partial integration doctrine. And to give an easier example, suppose the contract said, we're going to use the interest rate as published in the New York Times last month. You can't go to the Post and pull out an interest rate that appears there. You have to proffer something that's SunTrust Mortgage Guidelines.
Let me ask something, and this goes back to the interpretation and application of the law in Virginia, and maybe this is something that the partisans just didn't quite bring up, but it is interesting to note, we call this an insurance contract, we call this whole thing insurance, but it really is a financial dealing in some aspects of it. And in Virginia, would, if it was, let's say if you took it out of the context of being an insurance policy, if it was a financial dealing, would that same type of interpretation of ambiguity apply in that instance? And I understand that the parties have all gone with the assumption this is insurance, but this is more than this is insurance. It's clear to that, and it certainly, but you just haven't approached it from that angle.
You know, that isn't the question that's posed, but I don't think it would change the equation for two reasons. If you look at the Virginia Supreme Court's decision in Walker, for example, that explains the point of the parole evidence rule, it's because the fundamental imperative of certainty in contractual transactions, we got to make the writing matter. And part of that is you have to allocate responsibility for who makes it uncertain. So in a case where one party drafts and the other doesn't, and remember, they are in the business of drafting these policies. That's the whole game for them. You would still arrive at the same place, I think, under that rule. I do want to touch on Ascona, because they've got the holding of this case completely wrong. As you should see from the decision in 1987, 7 years after Ascona, by this court affirming summary judgment on the duty to on the ambiguity rule. Ascona was a case where the insurer obtained summary judgment. The insurer, not the insured. The court notes, we've got two fundamental disputes of fact that require reversal of the summary judgment. One was who drafted the policy, which immediately takes the ambiguity rule out of play. You can't decide it on summary judgment when you don't have the drafter undisputed. But the second was, the fight involved a flood control warranty provision. And the question was whether the insured's measures of flood control complied with that warranty. And there was evidence that the insurer had reviewed and approved those measures of flood control. So there was clearly a dispute of fact that required a trial. Now, the insured, looking to get, I guess, some unspecified advantage on remand or anyway, when they already had the reversal on those two points, tossed in the rule about ambiguity against the drafter. And all the court said is, we don't need to deal with that. We clearly have a dispute of fact, and so whatever the rule is, it dusted it off in that way. You have to understand what's said in that footnote against those facts and procedural backdrop, because as the questions from the panel pointed out, this idea that you can't apply the substantive law rule on summary judgment doesn't make sense. There's no dispute that the rule requiring construction against the drafter is a substantive law rule. There's no dispute about that.
How much ambiguity is necessary? I mean, what happens if the interpretations are equally plausible for both sides? Or if you have an instance where it appears that, let's say you have emails and things like that seem to favor the interpretation that United Guaranty has put forth, even though there's an ambiguity, how much is required in order to be able to get this belief that this should be construed in favor of the insured?
If, as long as the insured's construction is reasonable, that's what the quote I just read you from Borenstein said, if the insurer's construction is reasonable, the trier of fact can't find against the insured because it had a reasonable expectation of coverage. And I want to point out...
Reasonable in a vacuum or reasonable in light of the interpretation proffered by the other side?
An officer of the insurer didn't think it was reasonable.
Well, a couple of things. Remember, the district court looked at all of the evidence that's proffered. Several things to keep in mind. This whole misstep that occurred began when this construction was thrown at the insured years after the fact. And as the district court acknowledged, the insured got caught flat-footed. So people are misinterpreting all over the place, but under the objective theories of contracts, your subjective belief doesn't matter. These aren't operative. What they do after the fact, after the dispute has arisen, has no relevance to the contract interpretation. What does have relevance?
Does it have evidentiary value as to what the meaning really was? When an officer of the insured is that concerned that she allegedly do what she did, risk her career, risk her liberty?
Marginal. I mean, you don't know, I mean, number one, that would make the contract turn on the mistakes of an employee committed years later, and that's not consistent at all with contract law. But if you look at the operative events back at the relevant time, there's no dispute that SunTrust went to United Guaranty before it extended this credit and said, will you insure these loans? It never would have extended credit if it didn't have an understanding or expectation that there was coverage. It in fact underwrote them using a document called SunTrust Mortgage Guidelines. There's a declaration in the record at JA 394 to 95 from Doug Smith that explains this desktop underwriting requirement was not even a prudent underwriting practice for these types of loans because Fannie Mae had not even programmed it, the software for these types of loans. These were loans. The desktop underwriting program was a program for loans that Fannie Mae is willing to purchase. These weren't loans that Fannie Mae was willing to purchase because they were stated income, and Fannie Mae didn't program the software to permit this until 2007. So this is a requirement that if it had been brought up on the underwriting side of the house, the people who established these programs, they would have said, what are you talking about? The SunTrust document, that's why the SunTrust documents say they must be traditionally underwritten, because this would not be a prudent underwriting practice. So none of that evidence is going to ever go away. That's always going to be in the case, no matter what you infer from the Gavin Pettit email exchange, which this district court spent more time with those emails than any of us did. Understood that it couldn't rise to the level of overcoming this.
The breach of implied duty, of good faith in dealing, affirmative defense?
Sure.
Did you raise it?
Yes, absolutely. So
before trial?
We raised it before trial, and there's three
Tell
things.
Me where?
JA 198. It's right in the answer, number one. Okay.
So it wasn't raised for the first time by the trial judge and you?
No. Let me unpack.
Let me make sure I get you on this now, because I want to make sure I understand you.
Sure.
It wasn't raised for the first time after trial. You're saying that it was properly pled as an affirmative defense before trial, and you're going to point me to that in the record.
Yes, JA-198 is the answer. I'm going to point you to two sites, and I got to give you a little bit of explanation also. JA-198 raises that affirmative defense.
Which paragraph?
I think it's 7 and 8. I'm sorry. No, paragraphs 4 and 5. You see, materially breached the subject contract first, thus precluding from obtaining any relief, and United Guaranty may not be permitted to benefit from its bad faith conduct. And that's under affirmative defenses. That's one, point one. Point two, remember what the bad faith theory is. You took the premiums even though you knew you weren't going to pay. There is no dispute that that factual theory was raised. It was litigated, evidence was presented at trial. What they're complaining about is they didn't think the legal theory implied covenant, that label, was adequately asserted. But the theory, the factual theory, was very much part of the trial. Their ability to present evidence wasn't prejudiced.
Are you saying that by your allegations of a first material breach, that encompasses the good faith and fair dealing breach?
Not only that, but we also alleged...
Is that what you are saying to me? Is that...
That
says the same thing.
With this added piece of it, what we said the first material breach was taking the premiums without intending to pay, exactly what the court found to be the bad faith implied covenant breach. So there's no dispute about what we're alleging is the breach. There's no dispute about that. There's 18 places in the record where that got raised before trial. And I'll zero you into one in particular, JA 1139 to 1140. This is a brief before we ever got to trial, back when people are contending this can be resolved on the papers. Fundamental to any insurance contract is the proposition that the insurer cannot still bill for and keep premiums when it has no intention of paying benefits under the policy. Foremost Guarantee Corp versus Meritor Savings Bank, 910 FedSec 1118. That is, of course, the authority that the district court relies on for its bad faith finding. It's there raised before trial. The factual theory is consistently asserted.
How is United Guaranty being put on notice about its language? I mean, even in taking up premiums, I don't think that in and of itself would do it, but how are they put on notice?
The legal theory is clearly what we're saying is the breach is asserted there. The legal authority says it's an applied covenant. And so if you also look at the record of the bench trial, you'll see that the examination is about the reasonableness of this practice. That's what they're defending at that bench trial. All that happened is at the conclusion, the trial court says, let's get some supplemental briefing on this implied covenant. And even then, if they had really been as flat-footed, prejudiced, etc., there's a standard procedure available. You move to reopen. They didn't do that. They didn't move to reopen. They did this procedure where they lobbied an offer of proof and try to pin the record on that.
All right, Ms. Picoza, thank you very much. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Cordoza. Mr. Olson, you got a few minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. First of all, the Axona case, about which there's been considerable discussion, the court specifically said in that case, we find that either interpretation of the agreement is permissible if we find that either interpretation is permissible in light of both a technical reading of the policy and the actions of the parties. There being this substantial issue of fact, it was error for the district court to enter summary judgment.
You know, no mention of this is in the brief. This is really just a financial product as opposed to an insurance. And it may well be there could be some consideration, but it seems to be there is agreement by everybody here. We're talking insurance. Is that right?
This is an insurance case.
Okay. I want to make sure we're not talking financial products. So.
It's an insurance case having to do with financial products between two large, sophisticated, fully lawyered up parties. There's no reason why there should be a presumption against the insurer with respect to this. But this case specifically says, and it's controlling on this court, that with respect to Rule 56, if there's a reasonable difference of opinion, it's a question of fact, it must be resolved by a trial, not by summary judgment. But that's not necessary in this case because it is a partially integrated contract. My opponent just read from the contract the basic policy and said the company, the underwriting guidelines means the guidelines designated as such by the company. The word company in that agreement, this is JA233, the company is United Guarantee. You can read the whole document, and it's quite clear because it uses the word company as distinguished from insurer. So it's the guidelines, the parties specified, and this happens all the time. The Smith versus Smith case in Virginia is an example where they referred to the way the taxes have always been allocated. There was a reference to other documents because it was a continually changing procedure. So the guidelines had to be changed, and there was a reference to these other documents. That is a classic, a partially integrated contract. So it's not a question of ambiguity. It is what you have to look at to determine what the contract is. Then you look at the evidence, and what the evidence was, it showed that it was a set of guidelines just as specified by the policy to begin with that were constantly in flow and cumulatively agreed upon on an ongoing basis between the parties. The word SunTrust guidelines were United Guaranty's reference to the fact that they provided insurance to lots of different companies. These were the guidelines applicable to SunTrust. When the district judge says SunTrust guidelines must mean that they were created by SunTrust, that would he leapt to a conclusion that is not justified by the evidence or any rational thought. At minimum, it required a trial. And the trial would have demonstrated that even SunTrust realized that the United Guaranty construction of this was correct because there were these emails back and forth between the two representatives of the companies that were responsible for this ongoing relationship. And they suddenly decided, and this was the whole company, it was not just this one senior vice president. The court below attributed this to the whole company. That decision and those findings, which were clear and conclusive evidence, was not appealed. It was attributable to the company. It went as high as the CEO and the general counsel. They were all engaged in this willful blindness because they needed that evidence.
Your time runs out, Mr. Cardoza says he agrees this breach of implied good faith and duty is an affirmative defense, but he says SunTrust pled it as an affirmative defense.
They didn't.
The pages that he said it pled it on. How do you respond?
No, the reference was in the original pleading was not to the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. The whole record indicates that. The letters from the with respect to the attorney's fees and the statements in court, and ultimately, this is page 1418 of the joint appendix. This is the decision of the district court on that very point. He says, however, in the briefing of the first material breach defense, neither party has actually discussed the theory of good faith and fair dealing, even though they have discussed at length why United Guaranty's conduct in continuing to collect premiums was or was not proper. That is the decision of the judge. The whole record, we'll be happy to rest on this. This is something that came up later. United Guaranty objected to it. It asked to reopen the evidence, and then it made an offer of proof. Ultimately, this and the courts of Virginia in the Nextel case, the Ott case, and the Smith versus Smith case says, ultimately, take a look at the contract. If it's a reference to other documents, you have to look and try to construe the contract as a whole. And all of the evidence here, the fact is that SunTrust wanted to change the evidence is pretty conclusive evidence. That was prejudicial. The judgment should have been to dismiss the complaint because of the misconduct and fraud on the court.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
Thank all of the parties.